Len is the chief business officer of Helier, which he joined in 2014. And I should mention, Helier is a fairly local company, actually, here in Gilbert, just southeast of Phoenix. At Helier, Len is responsible for business development, strategy, commercial partnerships, and sales functions, and assisting with the oversight of other areas of Helier's business. He holds graduate degrees in environmental science, information systems management, and law, and will complete an MBA in the first quarter of 2017. During his early studies, Len completed internships with the Office of the Vice President of the U.S. and the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and conducted plant molecular biology research focused on non-Mendelian inheritance in legumes. Let's welcome Len to the podium.
As Gary said, I'm the chief business officer of Helier, which is a pretty small company, so that means that essentially I'm the guy who does PowerPoints when nobody else is called to do it. And as Gary mentioned from my bio, I am somewhat of a failed scientist. So I worked in science many, many years ago, found it to be very, very difficult. And along those lines, I think the caliber of the two presentations that preceded me, you're not going to see that here as much, but hopefully you'll find the story that I have to tell a little interesting and the technology a little interesting. I think if we've, outside of the box, probably now we're going to, you know, move so that the box is very, 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 very far away. So with that, let's get into it. So the point of the talk, besides the very, very long title, is to talk about whether or not the problem or the symptom of the problem could be part of the solution, and that's algae. So clearly we hear frequent reports about algae being a huge problem with algal blooms taking over the Great Lakes and obviously near the Mississippi Delta and in other places throughout the world, and this is not just a U.S.-related problem. We have this problem in the Middle East and in other parts of the globe. So in that respect, this is a question that we're interested in particular because we're a company that focuses on making products from algae. So besides Gary giving me a call over the summer, my story is really one of begins at least with two or three different forces. And those forces are all running their parallel paths but maybe colliding into inspiring us to look at what we could do with algae related to this problem. Now, I have to say something before we get started, which is, again, because this is an agriculture conference, at least there's an element of that. And when we go to agriculture conferences, we usually have to explain that when we're talking about algae, we're not talking about that algae. So, right? So there's really two things going on there. One is, you know, historically in agriculture, kelp has been used for many, 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 many years and decades. And today, kelp is a very vibrant part of the agricultural inputs. Seaweed extracts are used widely by people. It's a growing segment of the business. It has some types of stimulant effects on plants, et cetera. We don't do seaweed. We do pond scum. So we actually do the small microcellular organisms. That's our area of focus. So the first thread of my lines of synchronicity, right, and synchronicity again is these three seemingly unrelated things coming together, is the fact that our algae, the microalgae, is a biological sponge. So this guy is particularly good at absorbing stuff. Not just stuff that you want it to absorb, but it can often be stuff you don't want it to absorb. Arsenic was something that was mentioned by one of the speakers earlier. Algae is a huge fan of arsenic. Many microalgae just love to suck it up, which, of course, if you're in the business of making food and dietary supplement products, is not a good thing. But it does happen to us quite a bit. We've learned to master it, and we've learned a lot about the properties of this. Where's the pointer guy? Yeah. So here, what I'm showing you, this is, you know, there was some talk earlier about mines. And mine tailings and leachates and things like that. This is work that's happening in some of the universities right now. We've had the pleasure of partnering with some folks on this. However, we haven't gotten very far with it, and the reason is because of economics, right? To date, we have not been able to attract really the people to get interested about the money of cleaning up these sites. However, algae is showing some promise for it, and there are some interesting universities. University of Colorado is one of them, who's doing interesting work to seeing if algae can clean up these sites. Down here below is a little bit more closer to home in a commercial application. What I'm showing you here is actually Gatorade. It's not good Gatorade that you drink, but this is Gatorade waste. And you can see after a very short treatment, the algae is sucking up those nutrients and those colors. So this is the kind of thing that you can see, sort of the power of it. This is some of the work that we're doing here at Helier, which is really related to using the algae to suck up a distinct profile of minerals, and that would be to give an animal feed, an aquaculture feed, et cetera, with a distinct profile of minerals. So it's an interesting area of science. This is one of the threads, again, that's very interesting. The second thing that is a thread that is interesting but completely separate is the role of this critter, microalgae, in the soil. So most people, again, probably this is the one crowd where I'm going to say this where actually people would get it. But usually when we go around and talk to folks, they're like, why would you ever focus on that? And we try to remind them that it turns out that microalgae is a huge component of healthy soils, often ranking number three after our good friends, the bacteria and the fungi. So again, most people find this remarkably surprising that we'd have this organism distributed throughout the soil. Again, maybe in a convention of soil scientists, this is not a big surprise. But it's one of the things that's prompted us to look at the role of algae and how it pertains to soil and how it pertains to plant health. So the third thing, the third thread, which is again a little unusual, is the fact that my company is primarily owned by the Mars family. And you may know Mars because you've probably eaten M&Ms before in your life or known somebody who has, and you probably know Snickers. You may not know that Mars actually makes most of its money from pet care. That's where it's actually very, very large. It owns Science Diet, it owns Eukanuba, it owns Whiskas, and a whole bunch of brands. But if you sit down, as I had the opportunity to about a year ago, with the scientific leadership from Mars, their chief scientific officer, president of the company, and you ask them, tell me who Mars is, the answer that they'll give you is Mars is one of the largest agricultural companies in the world. That's how they see themselves. So, and there's a good reason for that, because, of course, these are people who have to rely on a ton of crop inputs to make their products all the time. Mint is something that Mars knows quite a bit about. Peanuts is something that Mars is heavily, heavily invested in. Not only that, but I'd have to give credit to the family. They're fourth-generation money. They're probably, I think they moved from the fourth richest to the third richest family collectively on the Earth. But they're very, very, very forward-thinking people. Fresh water, the environment, making sure that there's sustainability throughout the world is a very, very important thing to these people. So the influence of people like Howard Shapiro here, who's the chief agricultural officer, I believe that's his title, of Mars, and other folks like that had also a big impact on us. So these three things came together with us beginning to look at whether microalgae had a role in agriculture. And at first, we sort of tried this out as an amateur experience of just packaging up some algae and shipping it around to people. What we saw back in 2012 was enough experience that some things were happening. So we saw some pretty remarkable results on some crops. And that was enough in 2013 for us to start working with real academics like Dr. Patrick Brown, who's out of UC Davis. He referred us to David Holden, who's a well-known agricultural researcher. He does work for many of the leading ag companies around the world. And we started putting money into whether or not microalgae had a role in helping plants grow and helping soil be healthy. Because of the way that our company's set up, our backers believe in an earn while you learn philosophy. So we launched a product. We call it a beta launch, and we still say that we're in a beta launch mode because we're still learning a lot about the product. If you ask me today, how does microalgae work in agriculture, my honest answer for you will be, I don't know. We have a lot of good guesses, and we've heard a lot of really interesting theories, but proving those theories out has proved to be daunting. And I have to say, I came from pharmaceuticals before this, in between, again, being a failed scientist of today, and I find it remarkably easier than agriculture. You can always ask the person how they're feeling. You're only dealing with one species, and there's no elements of weather, soil, et cetera. So my hat's off to you, because this is some really, really hard science, and it can get exponential fast. I want to point out, in the second row, this fine gentleman, Dr. Mike Miller, who just recently joined our company as our head of R&D agronomist. And with him and with other people at Helia, we've been increasing the number of trials so that this year, for example, we'll run 50 field trials on this product. And we've scaled up an early research facility approach where we can go through about 100 to 200 algae strains a year, looking at their effects in this place. So the product, again, that we sell today is called Phycoterra, and it's a stabilized, it's actually inactivated algae. It's a liquid formulation. It really sits on top of NPK. Its NPK numbers are ridiculous. You would laugh at them. They're like 0.00003, I believe, something like that. But they're basically negligible. It seems like the product only really works, you know, again, Mike might kill me for saying some of these things, but it seems like it only really works well applied to soil. Foliar applications of this particular algae have been largely a failure. So there's something about this material getting into the soil that seems remarkably important. Other algaes, maybe not the case. There are some algaes that actually are wind deposited and rain deposited. You know, we'll see about those. But today, this seems to be something that has to get into the dirt. And the product really does three things, so I'll walk you through them real fast because this isn't really about a product sales pitch. The first thing is that it enhances yield of plants. 26% is an average where the data is positive. The data is not positive all the time. You know, probably it depends on the crop. So sometimes it's a 65-70% quote unquote win rate. But where we see positive results, we're seeing about a 26% enhancement of yield. That ranges all over the place. We just had one trial come back where it was 300%. We've had other ones where it's come back 6%. So very dependent. The algae seems to also be doing something in terms of emergence. It's making the soil conditions so that the plants come up faster. We've seen in the studies that we did with UC Davis about a one-day head start. Here you're just seeing some grower experience actually in Arizona with potatoes. And people tell me that's a few-day head start that seemed to sustain throughout. And then it also seems to help in terms of root mass, in particular something we see over and over again in the soil. So the reason I tell you this story about this product, getting back onto the topic, is we want to make algae. Right? So where most people hate algae and they're trying to get rid of the algae, we love the algae because we want to do something with it. And one of the key things we want to do with it is help grow plants. So that's where we see this cycle coming together. So around the time that Gary called, we were looking at two different things because we just had a board meeting, and we had a board meeting with Frank Mars, who's our chairman, and he's president of one of the divisions of Mars, a very forward-thinking guy. And he challenged us in that board meeting, how can you guys actually start to use runoff and do something with that? Can you reduce runoff and or could you use it to actually grow the algae and have a cycle here so that we have something truly sustainable? This slide is too complicated to get into, and I fear that mostly there's people in this audience who know this stuff better than I do. But the point is, as you know, that there's a good amount and a very highly variable amount of especially N and P in these materials. If we were to look at manure runoff, or if we look at even stormwater runoff, there's a good amount that people have measured in various ways. This is actually our data. And what we're showing here is four different microalgal strains that are used for different types of products today. They're very useful. Spirulina, for example, is a high protein-producing microalgae. It has about a 65% protein component to it. So it's used as a superfood in nutrition. Nanochloropsis produces EPA, which is a very, very important health product. Cetodesmus is actually probably one of its few places of utility is in plant agriculture. Besides that, it's kind of considered the weed of the algae kingdom. And Haematococcus is very, very valuable and very hard to grow. It produces something called astaxanthin, which is one of nature's most powerful antioxidants. And so all these algaes have very good commercial utility. And what we're showing in this data here is how many grams of algal biomass can I get for a gram of this type of input in a standard media system. So that standard media system has a basal amount of N, P, and K already in it, but if I'm going to add into it nitrogen or I'm going to add into it phosphorus, what will be the effect of that biomass? And as you can see, the effect is pretty substantial. So we can increase algal growth considerably with a gram of either one of these inputs. what we see generally is that in our experiments, and again, it's early days for us, is that we can take up far more nitrogen than is in a typical input with the algae. So it'll remove it completely, again, leaving with it algal biomass. Now, I have to put in quotes because it's not always the case. Phosphorus, though, is truly a rate limiter. And so all phosphorus, essentially in the experiments that we've done, will be completely absorbed. So, again, we can use this material as a basis for growing things, and we're looking at that. Again, it's early days for us, and I'm not sure that, for example, what you would consider a typical farm runoff would be good enough. Now, again, if you don't know algae, as I didn't know it before I joined this company, you might be surprised by that. And you might think of an algal bloom and go, well, God, that's a lot of algae. But it turns out that the amount of algae in an algal bloom is actually so dilute that for commercial applications, it's probably not good enough at all. However, again, concentrating that or finding concentrated sources of these things, for example, dairy waste, might be very good for a commercial application. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes next. We have a very slow but long-standing relationship with one of the largest dairies in the United States, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to get onto their property and do some work there with their waste. On the other side of the world, what we're also looking at, given what we've seen from what this algae can do in terms of improving crop performance in very without it contributing any NPK, is whether or not the microalgae can actually be used to reduce NPK and get good results. And this is some of the work that my colleague, Dr. Miller, there does. And what he saw in one of his recent trials was that with either 80% of typical fertilizer application or 60% application, in combination with these algal products, we were able to see that there is a statistically significant difference in terms of the yield of those products. So, again, this wouldn't be all of the results that we have, and it's very, very, very early days for us, but it's a very promising result to suggest that we might be able to reduce, actually, or help growers reduce the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus that they're applying to their soils in those standard fertilizers by using the microalgal products. So with that, again, this is really a start for us. We didn't intend to really work in agriculture, but it's been a really, really exciting run for us. It's consistent with kind of the founder's vision. And so we're making big investments this year, like I said, 50 field trials, 100 to 200 strains that are going through, and I think we'll see that slot going up and up and up again, because at least in our experience, we're not seeing a lot of people focused on this microalgae technology in agriculture and as it pertains to soil, so at least in a commercial setting. So we're very excited about that, and that concludes my remarks.
Thank you. We've got some time for questions.
I'll do my best. Yeah.
So how resilient are the microalgae for the terms of when you are growing, if you will,
yeah.
And after?
Yeah. So again, I'll preface my comment by saying I'm not an algae farmer, but I work with a lot of them. So, and I would say it's very variable. So Cetodesmus is a good example. Again, it's a weed of the algae kingdom. It will grow in many, many, many environments. The cyanobacteria is obviously that form the major component of the blooms. Those two strains would be particularly hardy. Another strain that we work with that's very common is called chlorella. Chlorella is abundant in freshwater lakes. It's a huge component of most U.S. soils. Those algae would be very, very strong. However, many other algae not so much. So Haematococcus that I was telling you about, which again produces this extensive material, it probably reflects the normal role of algae in the world, which is it's an opportunist organism. This is probably a lot of why it doesn't get research and also why it hasn't been applied into many commercial settings. I like to think of it as algae is the weak kid on the playground of life. It was born to have its food taken from it, and it was born to be beat up and killed by its friend bacteria, right? So in that sense, it can be very challenging. Yeah, it'll depend on the application which we're able to grow from it. Any other questions? Yeah, please.
You had a slide up there where you had a great range of yield benefits applying this material. I know working with humic substances, you also see a great range in benefit. But it seems like in stress systems, you may see more benefit than in non-stress systems. I was wondering if you've seen the same thing with this elbow product.
So, yeah, I'm going to ask Mike to share his thoughts in a minute, but we have seen some pretty exciting results in stress, both in drought stress and heat stress in particular. Look, you know, pretty compelling for some of the algae. So I think that may be the case. At least the guys at UC Davis, they were very interested in whether or not the presence, again, because our algae is inactivated. So some people work with live algae. We don't do that because on a commercial setting, of course, that's going to blow up jugs and totes. And, you know, people put this stuff in farms at 120 degrees in Arizona. And, you know, it's just not going to work. So, but the Davis guys at least thought even the presence of the algae material might be sending a signal through the soil to the plants. And that may have something to do with why we see the roots, root growth, especially in these stress situations. But Mike, do you have anything that you'd add to that?
No, I think you covered that pretty well.
Yeah. So I don't know if it's working the same way as a humic acid, or again, maybe it's slightly different. It'd be interesting to study that further. Yeah. I forgot to mention one thing too during my talk. We invited Gary to come over to the facility. As you mentioned, it's nearby. So on Wednesday afternoon, he's going to be our guest. But if any of you are interested in joining him and you're free on Wednesday afternoon and you want to see a different kind of farming, feel free to get with him. We're happy to provide you transportation and give you a short tour. So feel free to join for that. Any other questions? Yes.
When you talked earlier about having potential stormwater or maybe ag runoff potential, what are you envisioning in terms of like a field scale application?
Yeah.
Is it too early to kind of?
Yeah, it's still. It's still early, so I'd be interested. I'd be interested to hear what my colleague thinks. It's a little bit of a debate, right? So I can tell you that Frank Mars, but he's a billionaire, so he can think these kind of thoughts. You know, pictures that sitting literally on every farm. Again, I'm a failed scientist, so that makes me a little skeptical of things. So I find that personally hard to believe. But I could envision, because again, the source of a bloom, for example, even if you were to say we had bloom concentrations, it's not going to be enough for us to commercialize something out of it. So it wouldn't be economically sustainable. However, what was particularly interesting about the earlier two talks was to see how those technologies had been applied and could be used to sequester and concentrate these nutrients, right? And so one could envision either a natural combination or the application of those technologies, and this might be a stage of it. Much like algae is used today in wastewater cleanup, it's a secondary, usually, treatment after one or two bacterial treatments and other chemical and physical treatments. So I could picture that at some key hot spots, if you will, right? Perhaps when we're pouring into Lake Erie, we have a site sitting there, and that's where we would locate our algae production facility. Or maybe it's, again, near a place of high concentrations from dairy runoffs or things like that. But I don't know. Again, Mike, you're the agronomist, so what would be your thoughts?
Oh, I guess.
Yeah, it's an exciting field, and there's other people working on it too. We're not the only people who've looked at this, so let's see where it goes.
I'll give maybe a comment on this one. We have been working on this one for this water treatment of a few years ago, nitrogen phosphorus, especially with the NPDES limits. So we have seen that a lot of technologies are coming exciting. Like you and me at Chicago, we have been able to reduce the footprint to about 20% compared to basic type of farms for filling out the LP type of wastewater.
That's good.
Using a biofilm product vector.
Yeah. Yeah, it's shown some real history and some real promise, and there's a lot of people doing interesting stuff. And there's a lot of other companies, too, who are very forward-thinking about it. One of our competitors is doing work on Anheuser-Busch's, at least some of their materials, and I thought, you know, a great application. Yeah. So, again, hopefully it has a role, and we can take this organism that's been a little bit, disparaged, if you will, and give it a useful place.
Yeah,
Yeah, we've seen some companies who've approached us for those kind of things too. Yeah, one of the car, I can't name it because of confidentiality, but one of the car companies, for example, is trying to replace out their car seats, which they are made from soybeans because of the concern about food products. Yeah, with algae. So, yeah.
I had a question. One of the challenges we have in denitrification is temperature in the Midwest, especially in the spring when the snow melt is running off and so forth. The temperatures are quite cold, you know, 5°C. Would that affect algae production, and how sensitive is algae compared to
Yeah, I think it would quite a bit. So the great thing about algae is, as a classification, of course, it's not even a good biological classification because it's got five different orders within it, which are highly unrelated. But as a group of organisms, it's ubiquitous. So we can find algae in the Arctic, and we can find it in the desert. One of the algae we grow today, we source out of volcanic vents in Java. The reason we did is because it's contamination-free. So we love it. It grows at pH 2 and near boiling water temperatures. So it's a fantastic organism in many, many respects. So I think, again, broadly speaking, could we find an algae that would live in cold? Yes. The commercially applied ones, probably not so much. And they are very sensitive. And not only they're sensitive for the reasons I was telling this gentleman over here, right, is that, again, competition. So our friend Hemetococcus, for example, we don't grow him in the summer. We do seasonal crop rotation, just like a farmer would. Not because the Hemetococcus, but his main enemy in life is chytrids. And those chytrids love to kill the algae, and they like to really come out in the heat. So when it gets extremely hot, would become a problem for sure. Yeah, more to be done.
Interesting.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.